Welcome back to Generals and Napoleon, episode 74, General Beresford of the British Army. This episode is brought to you by NapoleonicImpressions.com. Please check out their website for unique gifts and souvenirs inspired by the Napoleonic Wars. Now, on with the show. With me today is the great Josh Provan from Adventures in History Land and author of a new book. Hello, Josh. How are you?
Hi, John. Happy to be back. I'm doing well.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Your new book, I'm super excited about, Every Hazard and Fatigue, The Siege of Pensacola. Can you tell us a bit about this new book?
Well, it is about the climax of the Gulf Coast campaign, which was conducted by the Spanish army under Bernardo de Galvez in between 1779 and 1781. This was the longest siege in North America up to that point. You can even make the argument that it's the longest formal siege in American history. But then you get to arguing with American Civil War people about the Siege of Petersburg.
that was here in Florida, right?
Yes, it was up in Pensacola, back when Florida was separated into east and western parts by the British. You had West Florida, which had its capital at St. Augustine. And then you had... East Florida, sorry.
East Florida
with the capital at St. Augustine. And then West Florida with the capital at Pensacola. And then you had it, which also composed of Mobile and the settlements from Manchac to Baton Rouge. So it's a weird distinction because that's Alabama and Mississippi and Louisiana today. Mm-hmm. But back then, that was West Florida. It was Florida on the Mississippi. And the Spanish conquered all of that in 3 years. And there was this epic siege at the end where the Spanish conquered the last bit of West Florida and opened the door to practically anything else they wanted to do.
Interesting. And where can we find the book? Just anywhere on Amazon or Hellion Books?
From an author's perspective, I really appreciate it if you buy it from the publisher itself, Hellion.com or .co.uk. I understand about budgets and that history books are on the more expensive side, so I don't blame anybody for getting their stuff from Amazon if that's where you want to get it. You'll be able to get it from Amazon as well.
Very good. Well, I appreciate you giving us the lowdown on the new book, and we're super excited to read it. Speaking of a British army figures, whether it was in Pensacola or in this case in the Napoleonic Wars, can you tell us a bit about the guy we're going to talk about today, William Beresford? Just a thumbnail sketch.
William Carr Beresford is one of the people very closely associated with the Duke of Wellington. Mm-hmm. However, he's not terribly well known. He's a little bit of a shadowy figure because he, like everybody, he stands in Wellington's shadow. But unlike some of the other generals that you, myself and Marcus have talked about on this podcast, the figure of Marshal Beresford is a little more obscure because he's not a field commander, so to speak, under Wellington. He is the commander-in-chief of the Portuguese army. Mm-hmm. He's very famous for a particular battle in the Peninsular War. Mm-hmm. And of all of Wellington's generals, it's probably fair to say that he stands amongst the top three or four that are particularly well known. We'll say five. The top five are the ones who are particularly well known.
Okay. Well, let's dive into them. He was born in October 1768 in Kent, England. Was the illegitimate son of George Beresford, 2nd Earl of Tyrone. What do we know of his upbringing, if anything?
Very, very sort of scant information, realistically. I think it's a fairly typical gentlemanly, aristocratic upbringing, to be honest. It happened with a lot of illegitimate sons. You'd think that they would be sort of cast aside, etc., but they always had a living. You would expect them to have an education. Mm-hmm. They just tend to sort of grow up with a chip on their shoulder and tend to have a lot to prove.
Mm. And oddly enough, he attends a military academy in France and then joins the British Army as an ensign. I know Wellington also studied at a French military academy. Was this common? Because it seems odd to me that two countries who were frequent adversaries for centuries allowed enrollments from their opponents.
Yeah, it is weird, but it's got a lot to do with the difference between aristocracy and nationality. The aristocracy and being a sort of native citizen, so to speak, they're very different beasts. And their aristocrats generally, in this period, are only inspired by patriotism in times of national danger. When that danger goes away, in theory, no one's supposed to hold a grudge.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, though, to keep in mind in terms of the military education that you might get at a foreign military academy, is that at that age, in the late 18th century, early 19th century, they're not really learning anything particularly dangerous as far as governments are concerned.
Right.
At military schools, to be honest, you learn to fence, ride, speak languages, some mathematics, history, and basic military theory.
Mm-hmm.
And the French and the Prussians are still considered the leaders in military theory at the end of the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very fashionable if you could afford to send your younger sons abroad to learn about a potential future career. So,
yeah,
actual practical applied learning only came when young officers got attached to the staffs of generals and battalions and stuff. So it's not necessarily giving away state secrets because, frankly, all conventional European armies work the same way anyway.
Right.
For instance, Wellington's education is almost like going to a male finishing school.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect it was with Beresford as well. He attended the school at Strasbourg in 1785. And he joined a battalion, I think, within the year. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't there for very long anyway. Mm-hmm. Generals Crawford and Hill, on the other hand, they attended military academies with a much more serious eye to a professional career. And I think Crawford and Hill studied towards Germany and Switzerland. So mm-hmm. There might be something in that if you're actually seriously wanting to learn military science, you might not go to a French one or just mm-hmm. use it as sort of like a finishing school. But more commonly, a military education was seen as an extension of normal liberal education. And of course, as I said, French education is highly sought after generally.
Right. And it makes sense. You know, you're learning different languages, you're learning different cultures, you're getting, you know, exposure away from England to, you know, mainland Europe. So I guess in that way, it does make sense to learn something different than what you've grown up around.
As a final thought, though, it's very key that all of this happened in the 1780s. You know, the education
mm-hmm.
we're talking about here, this is happening in the 1780s. It's not happening post-revolution.
Right. Yeah, good point. Okay. So from there, Beresford serves first in Ireland, and then he goes across the pond to serve in Nova Scotia. And during his time there, he loses sight in an eye due to a hunting accident, a la Marshal Massena. Do we know what happened there?
It's one of those nuggets of information that most potted biographies and books about larger campaigns talk about, but never usually elaborate on.
Mm-hmm.
Insofar as I can find out, this is because it was a fairly mundane way to lose one's sight,
mm-hmm.
if you can call a traumatic incident mundane. But basically, they were shooting partridges with buckshot, and one of the pellets fired from the gun of one of the party named Thomas Molyneux hit him in the left eye, which caused him to give the slight appearance of squinting for the rest of his life. And, of course, he was blind in that eye. So very unfortunate, but quite just an unfortunate accident.
Yeah, not a good start to your military career. But in 1789, he's promoted to lieutenant and then captain 2 years later. And then during the losing battle that was the French siege of Toulon, we find Beresford serving in the Marines. And this would begin his career against Napoleon and his armies. After this loss, the British pull out of Toulon and besiege Napoleon's home island of Corsica. And Beresford's notable here in a storming party that captured the French held Torre di Mortella. It seems like he was a natural leader of men, correct? Or was he just kind of learning his way in the army at this time?
That would be a bit of both, I think, to be honest. He's like many young gentlemen who had been raised properly, so to speak, and had been imbued and encouraged to lead. He'd been presented with an opportunity, many of them. When many of such people, such young men, such young officers, are given the opportunity to lead, many of them perform that office with incredible aplomb, to be honest, just to show their courage, their mettle, sort of own up to their lineage. Some might say some are trying to earn their place right from the ranks of the gentry and things like that. Beresford being illegitimate, he had some things to prove, perhaps, and he was a strong and imposing lad. And he seemed to find leadership under pressure quite comfortable, especially when he was younger. It's one of the strengths of having an aristocracy and a gentry, to be honest. You have a potential warrior class sort of ready to go if necessary.
Yeah,
it's interesting, right? He's at the siege of Toulon. There was another officer that we talked about who was at that siege. Graham was Graham. At Toulon.
Yep.
And of course, attacking Napoleon's home island of Corsica. So there's a lot of connections going on here.
Yeah, there are, and I wonder, it seems to me that there's two types of, and there's probably more. I'm probably just generalizing, but there's the fire and brimstone general like Crawford, and then there's the more reserved officer like Wellington, that'll do. And I think Beresford was maybe a combo. Like you said, he was an imposing man, but I don't know if he was out there yelling and screaming at everybody.
Beresford did have a temper. He showed it on a couple of occasions in the Peninsular War for certain. I don't know whether he had it when he was younger or not. Mm-hmm. He was certainly a brave man and physically very imposing. Mm-hmm. That must have helped to some extent.
Right.
And Crawford is an interesting guy. He has actually a reputation for being sort of fire and brimstone. He's actually, it should be narrowed back a little to him being an extremely strict disciplinarian. Because he actually knew his business. He had been very well educated as a soldier. He was one of the most sort of conventionally educated soldiers in the British Army, a little like Hill. He'd actually studied abroad seriously to the art of soldiering. And that's where that comes from. So there was sense behind his hollering, so to speak, unlike the likes of Picton.
Right, who just hollered to holler. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, after some time in the West Indies, Beresford is promoted to colonel and begins serving in India. And like a lot of Wellington's subordinates, he sees service around the globe. And I think this point is critical because in the later training of the Portuguese troops, you kind of learn how to work with troops that are not necessarily, from your native land. You work with foreign troops and kind of figure out how to get them in line with, British traditions or discipline. Is that accurate? Do you think that work around the globe helped Beresford later on?
Yes, I think it did. If you have global defense responsibilities for your empire, right? It's definitely a bonus in terms of giving your officers and soldiers practical experience of soldiering just generally, not even specifically dealing with foreign people, but just that they're not stuck at home in garrisons doing stuff in familiar situations. They have to go hundreds and thousands of miles away into hostile environments, and they have to maintain those standards far away from home. And even if you don't see action, and Beresford didn't really see action on his tour, so to speak, until he ended up, I think it was the Cape of Good Hope, I think, where he probably saw his action for the first time. So yes, I think it did help young officers, and indeed the soldiers in the battalions, to be honest, to be able to go on active service and learn campaigning in a way without necessarily being in danger of being killed by the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And India officers especially did seem to have a better handle on dealing with other foreign troops. So you may be onto something there.
Right. Yeah, that's just what I was thinking. In 1804, Beresford's promoted to Brigadier General. And a few years later, he is sent to the ill-fated invasion of the River Plate in Argentina. This was a disaster for the British and a huge victory for the Spanish. Can you tell us what happened there briefly? I know there's more to it, but it seems this did not go well for the British.
No, it didn't. It's one of the little known, little talked about disasters that you get prior to the Peninsular War.
Mm-hmm.
Just a host of sort of failures, non-starters outside of Egypt, operations that just don't land or are, and in this case was just ridiculously unsuccessful.
Mm-hmm.
It was a harebrained scheme that was hatched by Admiral Popham, I believe, after the capture of the Cape of Good Hope. And the idea was to snipe the Spanish colonial possession of Buenos Aires. Just by saying that, he transporting an army from, you know, one cape to another, practically, you can see that it's realistically unfeasible.
Mm-hmm.
And largely, it's done without official approval as well, because mm-hmm. I believe, and you can ask Jacqueline Reiter about this, she knows much more about it than I do. Her book on Admiral Popham is something you'll want to talk to her about.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming out soon. And he basically sort of had the idea, sent a letter back to Whitehall saying, I'm doing this, and went and tried to do it.
Mm-hmm.
He went along with General Whitlock and mm-hmm. Beresford, were the senior army officers, and they had some initial success, but eventually got trapped in Buenos Aires because it's obviously massively far away from anywhere the British have any control over.
Yeah.
So once they'd succeeded, they got surrounded and essentially forced to surrender. And it was an incredibly embarrassing blow to the British.
Yeah, it was brutal urban fighting in Buenos Aires. And I think the British just thought they would just show up, you know, with their navy and their guns, and the Spanish would run away, but it didn't work out that way.
Yeah, absolutely. The British had the lowest possible opinion of the Spanish, mm-hmm. And especially in the Spanish colonies. I don't think they really knew what they were up against.
Yeah, and Beresford had to surrender and remained a prisoner for 6 months before finally getting back to England in 1807. Afterwards, he's given arguably the most important assignment of his career, the training and rehabilitation of the Portuguese army. For those who don't know, what happened to the Portuguese army when Napoleon attacked?
The country was sort of just overrun really quite quickly.
Mm-hmm.
They just weren't large enough to face down Junot and his Spanish allies,
mm-hmm.
who they couldn't stop him getting over the border. Resistance crumbled very quickly in an organized manner. Much like in Spain, it fell to local militias, partisans, and what remained of the regular army to conduct insurgency warfare, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It was a miracle that they were, the French and the Spanish were held back long enough for the king to get away, to be honest.
Right.
And of course, resistance went into overdrive when Spain too rose in revolt. And this created the opportunity for the British to intervene in aid of the country, which, as you probably know, is actually, well, it's the common saying is that it's Britain's oldest ally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, just talking to Marcus Cribb about it, you know, when Juno and the French army attacked, it was almost like a James Bond countdown clock. Like the king and his retinue were on boats just trying to get out of there. And I mean, they had to leave even some of their gold and silver on the docks just to get out of there in time.
Yeah, I mean, Juno didn't handle the advance at all well, and people described the advance as almost like a retreat. But nevertheless, he was racing to try and capture the King of Portugal, and it was that close.
Yeah, amazing. So Beresford is tasked with overhauling the Portuguese army, training them in drill and discipline so they could stand in line with the British and stand toe-to-toe with Napoleon's troops. And in 1808, Beresford is made marshal and commander-in-chief of the Portuguese army. How did they perform in battle with the French after this training?
Very well, really. To begin with, they didn't. Obviously, you have to. There's a gap in which the training occurs,
right?
But you get an army, a sort of a new model army, you might call it, of around 27,000 men, and they're all equipped with British equipment, British muskets, British knapsacks, the whole ball of wax.
Yeah.
And they get given a new drill manual book. The Portuguese version is online if people want to Google that, if you can read Portuguese.
That's
that
cool.
Beresford wrote.
Yeah.
And with all of that, they came into line in around September of 1809 and guarded that really did allow Wellington to launch the, you know, in his raid into Spain in a way, knowing that Beresford had a good chunk of solid troops behind him. But I don't believe they were involved in the Talavera campaign to any great extent. You get them organized into small brigades attached to the main British force to begin with, under people like Pack and Trant.
Right.
And it's unfair to say they didn't fight early on in like Rolitha and Vimeiro. There were Portuguese troops involved in that campaign and in the expulsion of Soult, the Battle of Porto and stuff like that. It's just they weren't the full cadre of the troops that Beresford had trained. He hadn't finished yet.
Right.
So they're very impressive. Wellington is very impressed by what Beresford achieves. It's one of the things that brings him to his notice. Wellington is a details guy. You know, he loves logistics, he loves order.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that Beresford was able to turn these guys around in about 3 years to what Wellington recognized as a proper level,
right,
was very impressive.
Indeed. Well, as you mentioned, Marshal Soult and his troops are ejected from Portugal after the Battle of Porto. Beresford works with Wellington in defeating the third invasion of Portugal, this time by Marshal Massena. How did they perform at the Battle of Busaco, which was a pretty big defeat for the French?
Yeah, the Battle of Busaco is where the new model Portuguese army gains recognition as truly solid troops. The circle is completed. You know, they obviously look good, they march well, they're disciplined. Can they fight? Can they actually go toe-to-toe with the French? And this is where they show that they absolutely can.
Yeah.
Wellington really likes predictably reliable troops in this way. You know, there's nothing he likes more than being able to depend on something that he's not looking at to do what he expects it to do.
Yeah.
So Beresford received several British and Portuguese honors for his role in the defense of the ridge. And Wellington was satisfied that these guys could be properly relied on.
Yeah, and I think Napoleon and probably Massena probably underestimated the Portuguese units. I think Napoleon just discounted them that, you know, yeah, you said these 27,000 Portuguese, but we can roll over them. And I think they were kind of surprised when they were excellent frontline troops, and Napoleon had to refigure his calculus on that.
Yeah, the third invasion of Portugal's a fascinating campaign in the sense that you get this sudden realization from the French that the whole 1808-1809 fiasco wasn't a fluke. And Massena at Bisacco realizes that, oh, darn it, I actually have to use my brain and fight an actual capable opponent. Right. I didn't sign on for this. I've been a soldier all my life. I really don't want to be here. Right. And now I have to tangle with Waddington, and now he has allies that can fight too. This isn't fair.
Right. And on top of that, shortly after Bisacco, Massena comes across the lines of Torres Vedras. I know there was an engineer, a British engineer, who oversaw the construction of the lines, but I know Beresford played a role in that as well, correct?
Yes, he did. Like you say, I don't think he was directly involved in the building of them, mm-hmm. so to speak, but he definitely, his soldiers, his army, you know, the Portuguese army, absolutely garrisoned important portions of the lines. And I mean, to be honest, you don't read his name in conjunction with them all, with them at all that much, but he was probably in charge of sections of the construction, and he was most certainly, he and his soldiers, the Portuguese, were most certainly responsible for guarding them through the winter.
Right. And, you know, guard them they did, and finally Massena has to leave Portugal as the French do for the last time. But in 1811, our good friend Marshal Beresford is almost defeated at the Battle of Albuera. In fact, it's an inconclusive battle that was the bloodiest one-day battle of the Peninsula War. Did he make a strategic error there? What, I know Soult caught him napping. What happened there?
Albuera is almost, it's very similar to the Battle of Fuentes de Oñoro, in a way, in that both British commanders, Wellington and Beresford, commit certain blunders, quite frankly, that almost lead to their defeat.
Mm-hmm.
With Albuera, the thing is, Beresford isn't Wellington, so he doesn't respond as well, or as neatly, you might say, mm-hmm. to the threat that occurs. And that's why there's so many casualties.
Mm-hmm.
Soult gets a really bad rep in Spain and Portugal,
mm-hmm.
because of things like Porto and the fact that he always seems to lose and stuff like that. But he is one of Napoleon's finest marshals,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that you can absolutely rely on him to keep an army intact and to do great damage with it if you let him do so.
Yeah, yeah. And the great line, I pierced their center, I crushed their right, and they just didn't know when to run. You know?
Yes, exactly. He said that he said something like the British were completely beaten, but they did not know it and would not run, or something right. like that, which is completely true. Soult completely wrong-footed Beresford. He did the classic French thing, which Massena did at Fuentes de Oñoro as well. Wellington fell for it too. You attack hard in the center, and then swing equally as hard around a flank.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you do that, reinforcements are already supposed to be moving to support the center, which you're attacking and putting pressure on, and therefore it weakens the flanks. Mm-hmm. So you can strike and break that and roll it up. It's how small armies get the drop on bigger armies,
mm-hmm.
and the French are very good at it. The problem is Soult's strategy is undone by the dogged determination of the Spanish and British infantry. They meet on Beresford's right flank, and they just can't break through and eventually are repulsed. but it's a desperate slogging match, and at one point Beresford physically has to wrestle a Polish lancer off his horse during one of the crises of the battle. And this is why there's so many casualties, just because it was a massive pounding match with both sides just giving each other body blows all day.
Yeah. And I know Wellington wasn't there, and he was aghast when he heard about it. And I think he told Beresford to say, no, you know, write me down to victory.
Yes, he did. Beresford was devastated by the by the losses. He blamed himself, which is a very, you know, honorable thing to do. He was the commander in chief. He had made the calculation error, and he was so despondent at the amount of losses he had sustained that his Wellington felt you couldn't have sent that back to the government because they would have basically decided it was a defeat. And Wellington was at a point in the war that he couldn't have the government and the opposition especially questioning the casualties that he was sustaining,
right,
in Portugal and Spain. And Beresford was sort of leaning too heavily on the losses rather than the achievements, which, right. I mean, that's to be fair to Beresford, there wasn't a great deal of achievement in it, because the battle forced him to properly lift the siege of Badajoz.
Right.
So it's more, realistically, it's a strategic French success and a tactical French defeat.
Right. Right. Now, it's an interesting battle for sure. And I'll come back to that maybe on the podcast. It's a very intriguing story. But getting back to our protagonist, in 1812, Beresford participates in the sieges of Ciudad Rodrigo and Badajoz, as you mentioned, which were victories for the Allies. So that's good, right? Some positive vibes after.
Yeah, absolutely. These were the so-called keys to Spain. Badajoz had been a problematic thing to approach for a few years now. Beresford was supposed to have besieged and taken it in 1811, and Albuera nipped that in the bud. And Wellington needed to secure both Ciudad Rodrigo and Badajoz before he could launch his invasion into Spain.
Right.
Despite Beresford's lack of faith in himself, Wellington never lost faith in Beresford. Mm-hmm. And he sort of gave him a theoretical, though seemingly it wasn't a terribly active command of about, sort of like the oversight of three divisions, especially during the siege of Ciudad Rodrigo. And this just goes to show that Wellington forgave a lot of stuff that Beresford did, like Albuera, mm-hmm. and not being able to take Badajoz in 1811. And if it had been another general, he may not have forgiven him. That's how much he respected and valued Beresford.
Right. Well, later in 1812, Beresford fights in the famous Battle of Salamanca, which is one of Wellington's masterpieces. But Beresford is injured in that battle. Do we know what happened to him there?
Yeah, very simply, he was wounded by a musket ball during the British advance, and the wound proved very tricky to deal with because, as was actually quite common, a piece of his uniform got driven into his chest with the ball.
Mm.
And they got the ball out, I believe, but they didn't get the piece of material out.
Mm.
So it took a long time to deal with, and what just wasn't healing. Apparently, it took until the spring of 1813 for surgeons to find and extract this piece of material.
Yeah.
And therefore, it took him a long time to recover. That's ghastly, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, he spends, like you said, the next year recuperating and then makes it back to the front for the final 1814 Battle of Toulouse, another victory for the Allies. This next question is a little tricky. Many subordinates are considered to be the right-hand man of Wellington. Hill, Graham, Crawford, to name a few. But do you think it was Beresford? I know this is a hotly debated topic on who was truly his right-hand man.
Well, it is, I guess it is hotly debated. A lot of Peninsular War buffs, so to speak, have their favorites. For my money, though, I don't think he counts as Wellington's right-hand man particularly. Not in the way people would use the term. Wellington trusted Beresford implicitly, but the Duke tended to derive more almost a sort of moral support from Beresford that he didn't derive from other people, mm-hmm. other generals. It was as if he drew sort of a comfort from his physical presence, you know, the big man in the room. He was very capable, and he had a logical mind, and he was good at organization. And Wellington enjoyed his company and conversation, to be frank.
Right.
That counted a lot to being successful with Wellington, is if he actually liked you.
Right.
And like I said, we said at the beginning, Wellington was a details man. You know, he loved to be able to track a piece of hardtack biscuit from a soldier's knapsack to the crate it came in on at Lisbon. And Beresford was that kind of guy too.
Right.
Now, he wasn't the best field commander, but Wellington had called him the ablest man in the army.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after Albuera, he liked Beresford a lot, but he kept him close to headquarters. He didn't allow him to go off again with an independent command, really, when things were dangerous.
Right.
Interestingly, he's actually described by other people as being a difficult guy to get along with because he was very direct in his manners
mm-hmm.
and quite sharp in his temper when irritated. And again, that's kind of like Wellington, right?
Right.
So I think Wellington's right-hand man is another episode, to be honest. I don't think it's Beresford in a military sense.
Right.
But I also think that a lot of people don't actually realize who Wellington's right-hand man it is, and it might surprise some people. So maybe we'll do another episode on that.
All right. A little teaser for our next episode. That's good. Well, he does not participate in Waterloo that I'm aware of. And after Napoleon's downfall, what were the later years like for Beresford? Did he marry? Did he have kids?
Yes and no.
Okay.
After long service with the Portuguese army, which took place in Portugal and as far as Brazil, he stayed with the Portuguese until the 1820s, I think. He married his cousin, Louisa Hope, mm-hmm. who was actually one of the richest widows in England, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
But they had no children. And between returning to Britain and his death, he held many important administrative posts, Master General of the Ordnance, and he bought a country estate in Kent, but he did get married, but they had no children.
Okay. Well, he passes in 1854 at the old age of 85. What do you think his legacy is? Because I've been trying to think about it myself, and he's always mentioned in the history books. You know, like I said, he rebuilt the Portuguese army. He was pivotal for Wellington and building up the Peninsula Army for Britain, but is he one of the legendary field commanders of all time? I don't know.
Yeah, he's definitely not one of the sort of legendary field commanders. Like a lot of Wellington's generals, even the really good ones, he's very much a British senior commander, and that means that he's sort of the caliber of some of the generals who lost the American Revolution, etc. Mm-hmm. You know, they know what they're doing. They can command armies, but there's nothing startling about them. Like Wellington,
mm-hmm.
Wellington stood out for a reason. Mm-hmm. And Beresford is definitely a sort of a classic British 18th century general.
Mm-hmm.
He is slightly better known than Hill, I'll say, and mm-hmm. possibly Graham, just because of Albuera. Because mm-hmm. so many people know about how deadly that battle was, and he is the guy who is in charge of it. But that's really all he's known for, principally. Once you start reading about him, you learn that he was the marshal of the Portuguese army, and that he did all that work, which is an incredible achievement.
Right.
But that is sort of the on paper legacy. We should pay attention to the fact that Wellington really valued him, though.
Mm-hmm.
That's also a legacy. And actually, Wellington later remarked that if he had been personally injured or killed, he'd have wanted Beresford to command the army.
Okay. Well, that's praise. Yeah. That's pretty high praise.
It is indeed. Now, personally, I think that it probably would have ended up being given to Graham.
Yeah.
But Wellington wanted Beresford, I think because he knew that Beresford would take care of the army.
Yeah. I was trying to equate him to one of the marshals, and it was more Oudinot or Lan or more of a Marshal Ney. He was a stout man. He could command on his own, but I couldn't really equate him with anyone. He's kind of like his own.
Yeah, that's a very difficult game. He's because he's
Yeah.
not as brilliant. He's not as brilliant as Lan. He's as tough as Oudinot, but then again, he didn't get wounded as much as Oudinot.
Nope.
We don't
I don't think
actually
anybody did
know.
that,
No.
but you're right. I mean, you make a great point, Albuera. I mean, that could have been a disaster. I mean, that army could have folded very easily, and he held it together. So that's a fine point.
He did his best. I mean, in complete and utter impartial fairness, it is very much a soldier's battle of where Beresford reacted as fast as he could. Not as fast as Wellington did at Fuentes to the same problem.
Right.
But yes, he didn't lose the battle, and he did react in time, just in time, to save it. And as we were saying before, I mean, for whatever reason, Wellington thought that he would be able to take care of the army if anything happened to him.
Right.
So let's say that maybe he wasn't Wellington's right-hand man strictly, but maybe he was sort of like the steady walking stick that his right hand leaned upon.
All right, let's go with that. I like that. That's a very good way of putting it. My. Well, that was very interesting on Marshall Beresford. So thank you for that, Josh. One more time of the book. It's Every Hazard and Fatigue, The Siege of Pensacola. And yeah, I think it's a very intriguing book. What are you most proud of the book? What parts really stand out to you there?
My favorite parts of the book that I'm particularly happy with are the inclusion of a lot of British headquarters correspondence that will allow you to see the challenges faced by the British commander in Pensacola. A lot of books tend to focus on the Spanish, as rightly they should, because Bernardo de Galvez is epic. But there's a lot of headquarters correspondence that I've never seen produced before, and I produce it there. Most specifically, I'm very excited to share with people some of the records from the British Department of Indian Affairs, and the role played by the Muscogee, who are also known as the Creek, the Choctaws and the Chickasaw Nation in the British defense of West Florida. And I was over the moon to actually find out one of their names. One of the war chiefs who defended Pensacola from the Choctaw Nation. I actually have a speech he gave and his name, and I have reproduced it for people because it's not reproduced in full elsewhere. So that was really fun. And there's also a really cool story about a British camp follower, which I will not go into right now because I want you to read it in the book because I'm trying to sell this book. But that's an amazing thing too. A lot of this stuff I found out just as I was finishing the book, and so it just made it in, and I'm really happy about that.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Again, it's Hellion Publishing, Hellion Publishing House. So by all means, go there first. Amazon is a backup. And I really appreciate you sharing the book with us and sharing your knowledge about Marshall Beresford.
My pleasure. I'm always happy to come back, talk about Wellington's generals. Looking forward to who you throw at me next. You're getting a good catalog of British generals. Maybe we have to go to Russia next.
Yeah, or the Spanish, or yeah,
Indeed.
I'm running low on the British, so yeah, I'll have to widen my net, I guess. But yeah, thank you again, Josh, and yeah, we look forward to talking with you again soon.